Welcome to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. You know, on American Variety, we're partial to adventurers, and I've had many on as guests over the years. Explorers and astronauts and hunters of Spanish treasure and even long-ago downed aviators in the jungles of the South Pacific, including Amelia Earhart in one case, and many other adventurers. My focus today is on a little-known American who I've been interested in doing a show on for about a year, and I finally tracked down someone who can be the perfect guest for this. And I think this person who's the topic of my show is actually a paramount example of an idealistic adventurer, someone who should be almost a celebrity, I think, in American pop culture, but whose story was suppressed for political reasons so that he remains almost unknown here. William Morgan was the son of a solid, prosperous family in Toledo, Ohio, who rebelled and was a misfit, a self-destructive failure in everything he did in his early years, until he wound up in Cuba at the start of the Cuban Revolution in the late 50s, where he then quickly became a top military leader, a comandante, and along with Che Guevara, was one of Fidel Castro's inner circle. But when Castro turned communist, William Morgan turned against Castro and was eventually executed. So my guest today is Aaron Shetterly, who's the author of a 2007 book titled The Americano, Fighting with Castro for Cuba's Freedom. It may seem strange to equate Fidel Castro with freedom, but at the start of the revolution, that's the way it seemed. He was on track, it looked, to set up a capitalist parliamentary democracy. So Aaron will tell us all about that and the short, colorful life of William Morgan. Welcome, Aaron.
Great to be with you, Court.
Thanks for being on. So your book in 2007 seems to have kindled a reemergence of Morgan into some degree, at least, of public awareness. I know it led to a long article on him in The New Yorker in 2012, and really the first time I ran across it, I think, was an episode of American Experience on PBS in 2015 called American Comandante. So let me start by asking you to describe Morgan's early life before Cuba.
Sure. Just a quick note on the subtitle, Fighting with Castro for Cuba's Freedom. It depends a little bit on the meaning, what the meaning of with is. So that could mean either against or together with. That's why I enjoyed the play in that subtitle. So Morgan's father was an executive at Toledo Edison, the electric company for Toledo, Ohio. They grew up. They lived, and Morgan grew up in a fashionable neighborhood in Toledo, down the street from the Catholic church that the family attended. The father liked making home movies. He was a scout leader. He collected stamps. The mother was Miss Cathedral. They were a well-to-do, well-thought-of family, upper middle class in Toledo, Ohio. And we're talking about the late 1920s and the 30s and into the 40s. When Morgan was growing up there. He was born in 1928, the same year, actually, as Che Guevara in Argentina.
Yeah, so his family seems so strong and so functional, you know, as you describe, prosperous, well-educated parents and a loving home. But right away, even in high school, he started getting into trouble. I guess he stole a car and it was kind of a carjacking thing. And, you know, so tell us more about some of the trouble he got into just briefly right away.
He was getting in trouble from the earliest age, even before high school. When he was in grammar school and middle school, he was a kid who just never really fit in there. One classmate of his referred to him as sort of a lost soul. Another one said, no one ever really liked Billy Morgan. He had a different kind of energy, a different sense of what was interesting than a lot of these kids who, you know, sort of hewed more or less to what was expected of them in their social circles in Toledo. What's interesting a little bit about this, though, is Toledo wasn't such a simple place. Toledo had another personality, too. It had an underbelly. It was considered to be one of the great R&R towns during World War II. There were brothels. There were gangsters with nicknames like Firetop Sculpin, Chalky Red, and the Muzzler. I mean, almost cartoon-like. Hmm. You know, it was a real union town. This was an industrial town, and it was a union town with tough guys. And Morgan was clearly, from a pretty young age, drawn to these stories. You know, the kids would play games like FBI and bootleggers in Toledo, and leave it at that. Morgan clearly was a little more interested in what the bootleggers were up to than most of the other kids he was playing with.
So, you know, it's funny that in the American Experience show, and we'll tell you, listeners, at the end of the program how to get to that on the PBS website, but his father, being a prosperous guy and maybe a creative guy, had a movie camera early on. I mean, in the maybe even late 30s, and took color film of the family. So you see, which is very unusual at the time, you see home movies that are well done of William Morgan as a little kid. I mean, like a toddler practically, and then growing up, and you can see the kind of frenetic energy he had. I mean, he looked like a bright, talkative, happy kid, really. But you know, so nothing unusual looking about him at that point. That which makes it even stranger that he became basically such a ridiculous midfit. And we'll go into that a little bit more. But at a certain point, I think he was given the choice of going to jail or joining the army. Right. So he joined the army. What was his experience in the army like?
The thing is, he dropped out of high school partway through his sophomore year, down and joined the Merchant Marine right there on Lake Erie. Got mixed up down on the docks with, you know, some tough guys and who were connected to mobsters. He really wanted to get into the army, and he tried three times before he turned 18 to get into the army. When he finally turned 18 in April of 46, the war was basically over, and he was sent to be part of an occupying force in Japan. This was a guy who was a prankster, you know? I mean, he would climb trees and peek in his classmate girls' windows and get in trouble for it. And this carried over. I mean, when he was 18 and taking the train across the country to go to basic training in California, he met a woman on the train who was a couple years older, thought she was attractive. She thought he was attractive. They got off the train in Las Vegas, got married, spent a couple nights together, and then went on. And he went off to Japan, and she went home to California, to Sacramento. I mean, this was the kind of thing that this guy would do. Unusual, to say the least.
Yeah, very impulsive. So I think he went to Japan and got a Japanese woman, girl, pregnant, and then was unable to get a pass to go see her when she was about to have her baby. And so he went AWOL, right, was arrested, and then escaped from the brig by overpowering a guard, right, and was then recaptured and court-martialed and given a dishonorable discharge. I mean, I'm kind of running through this because I want to get to the story of him in Cuba, which is the core of our story here today. But he spent then like nearly 3 years in a federal prison for that. So the guy was really impulsive and just almost reckless. I guess he was reckless, right? He didn't care what happened to him.
He was reckless. Now, just to put that Japan moment into a touch of context, though, and I think it's important to focus on it for a second, because I think out of this experience in the being imprisoned in federal prison for 3 years and being dishonorably discharged from the military, however much he's aware of his own recklessness getting him into that trouble, it leads to some degree to his openness to a critique of America. Being part of this occupying force in Japan in 46 and 47 was a pretty miserable experience. I talked to other people who were there. It was cold. They were all getting sick. The brig was full of people who went AWOL. Morgan, though, people did not overpower guards and steal their weapons and go off then get caught for that. That was a whole nother level of going AWOL than what most of these guys were doing, who were sneaking around trying to find, you know, Japanese girlfriends or what have you. But yeah, you're right. Morgan had a Japanese girlfriend, got her pregnant, and ended up in prison in the United States for a number of years and ending up being discharged down and out and heading back to Toledo to become a janitor at his former grammar school, you know, Catholic grammar school, and trying to figure out how to turn his life around.
He's had a checkered career already, and he's only like, 20 or something like that. But Morgan joins the circus in Miami, right? Goes to join the circus. And it's funny that some of the video that's shown of him in American Experience is of him at the circus, and he's really enraptured with the animals and all. So that's kind of a funny thing that, you know, it's such a direct connection between that film and what he later does. So he joined the circus, he became a fire eater, and he married the resident snake charmer, who evidently was a beautiful but charming girl for a snake like Morgan. So, I'm doing some of the segue here because there's a lot of story here. But in Miami, then, he heard about this emerging revolt in Cuba against the dictator, Fulgencio Batista. And in 1957, Morgan decided to go down to Cuba to join the fight for democracy. So take it from here. I mean, how did he get to Cuba, and how did he try to hook up with Castro's anti-Batista forces in Cuba?
The whole circus piece is such a strange and almost surreal part of his life. I guess a lot of parts of his life are, but yes, fire swallowing, marrying a snake charmer, also around this time supposedly doing some work for Meyer Lansky and the mob down there, which is the important connection then to Cuba activity. Because where Morgan gets connected to Cuba is through gun running into the rebels. So while the United States was not selling guns, obviously, to the people fighting against the dictator Fulgencio Batista, there was a great demand on part of Castro and the rebels in Cuba for guns. And there were back channels that were providing them with guns, some of them through Guantanamo, the U.S. Navy station there, and then others through other means. And the mob was providing a lot of these guns. And so Morgan started, you know, helping do that, helping deliver these guns by boat, probably, from Miami into Cuba.
And I should interject here that for those listeners who may not know, Cuba, in particular Havana, was a, it was kind of like the Las Vegas of the time. It was the party place of the, of, you know, the Northern Hemisphere. It's where people went to let it all hang out and kind of, you know, whatever happened in Havana stayed in Havana kind of thing. And so the mafia were deep into that and running the big nightclubs like Copacabana and the Tropicana. And so the mafia had a major, you know, kind of interest in what was going to happen in Cuba. And they might, maybe wanted to support both sides, right? So that's how he got involved in running guns for the mafia down into Cuba.
Yeah, let me set that moment just for a second. I mean, you're so right. I mean, Havana literally was Las Vegas before Las Vegas. I mean, the reason Las Vegas exists is because Havana, Fidel Castro shut down Havana as the place where this gambling and this sort of, you know, exuberant and no holds barred nightlife could take place. In this moment, you have this dictator Fulgencio Batista, who's seized power in 1952. And after that point, Miami becomes a hotbed of revolutionary activity, trying to figure out what to do. So it's no surprise at all that Morgan came into contact with that down in Miami during that time. People would leave Cuba and plan how to get back to Cuba if they were on the outs with whoever was leading Cuba at that time. And that's still the case, right? So you had a society in which there were more Cadillacs per capita in Havana, Cuba, than any other city in the world. You had this place with this extreme wealth disparity. You had 70% of the business owned in Cuba was owned by Americans. And so you had people who were frustrated by that to some degree. And because of this activity, Fulgencio Batista, the dictator, was becoming more and more brutal and killing people and imprisoning people for even writing Fidel Castro's name anywhere. So, you know, this is the situation that Morgan walks into in 1957, where it's a hotbed of revolutionary activity, of people trying to figure out, well, how can we take this country back from this guy who's brutal and catering, in their minds, too much to the Americans.
Yeah, so he wanted to get to Castro, but Castro was in the eastern part of the country with his you know, his gang of insurgents, basically, and there weren't that many of them, and they were in the Sierra Maestro Mountains. But all of the rebels in Cuba who were anti-Batista were not under Castro. In fact, there was a second group called the Second Front. And so Morgan ended up joining the Second Front in the Escambré Mountains because basically he wasn't equipped with enough resources to get all the way to where Castro was. So that was kind of a pivotal key thing in Morgan's, what turned out to be Morgan's short but intense future in Cuba. So how was he received when he finally did hook up with the rebels in the Escambré Mountains under the Second Front?
So this American who is overweight, dressed in a white suit and city shoes, hikes up into these mountains, led up into these mountains, and enters this rebel camp of these young, idealistic lawyers, doctors, small business owners who have decided to rise up against Batista, and suddenly appears among them. He's actually at, you know, 29 years old. He's older than a lot of them, most of them, in fact. And they take one look at this guy, and it's just bizarre. It's, how did this guy get here? What is he doing here? And one of the things that concerns them immediately is that they're doing these long hikes to sort of reconnoiter and figure out where the Cuban military is. And they look at him, and they think, how is this guy going to be able to keep up with us on these hikes? and how much of our food is he going to eat? We don't have that
Well, I think it's also a, they thought he was a CIA spy. I mean, here's a guy who's, as you say, he's like kind of chubby. He's not fat, but he's sort of a chubby older guy who's, you know, overdressed and totally looking out of place. And they figured he was maybe Russian KGB or a Batista undercover mercenary or some, you know, they figured he was very suspicious. So they didn't trust him at all right away. So
they did. That's exactly right. But one of the things that gave them a little comfort on that front was that he didn't speak any Spanish. Mm. And they figured, well, no one would be stupid enough to send a spy out here who didn't speak Spanish. So they were unsure, but he had to prove himself. That's what he ended up doing. He ended up proving himself by being courageous, by showing them that he had some military training and could actually make them better soldiers. These guys didn't have any military training whatsoever, and began to earn their respect.
You know, one thing that struck me as interesting was right off the bat, one of the things he did to prove that he might be on the up and up was that he drew a line on a tree and then walked off about 50 feet from it and took a knife and he threw the knife and he stuck it right in the line in the tree. And this was part of his circus training. But that impressed these guys like, whoa, this guy has a skill.
Exactly. And Roger Redondo, who was one of the young men up there, came back through the woods just as Morgan had arrived, and Morgan had taken his shirt off. And he saw this guy and he said it was the whitest thing he'd ever seen was Morgan's back. And then Morgan throws the knife. It impresses them. And then he goes through their meager collection of weapons and says, you know, which ones are good and which ones are bad. And sits down with Aloy Gutierrez Manoyo, who's the leader up there. And Manoyo, through a translator, says, you know, who are you and are you a communist? And Morgan says, no, of course I'm not a communist. So Manoyo decided to take his word in that.
You're listening to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. We're talking with Aaron Shetterly, who is the author of a book in 2007 called The Americano, about a guy named William Morgan, an American, who went to fight with Fidel Castro's rebel forces against the dictator Batista in Cuba. And so we're at the point now of how he's joined up with not with Castro, actually, but with a secondary group called the Second Front, who were allied against Batista with Castro. But the politics of the group competition and mistrust between them came into play later, too. So they kind of, it's a long, interesting story. We don't have time to tell really in the details, but certainly people can get your book, and we'll talk about that at the very end. But he began very quickly to go from being someone who was mistrusted and they were about ready to shoot because they thought he was a spy or a plant of some sort, to being their commander. And, you know, along with the guy you mentioned, Manoyo, he became like the co-commander of this Second Front group. And they began with his training to win some battles against the highly trained Batista military forces and better armed and all that, right? So he became kind of a hero to them over time, because he was very brave, as you said, and when they would go into battles where they were outnumbered, they would win. So talk for a minute, if you would, Aaron, about his encounter with Che Guevara, who was with Castro in the other mountains further east, and then the whole process of joining forces with Castro.
Morgan comes into the picture in the Escambray in late 1957, and by the end of 1958, it's becoming clear that the Batista's military, the Cuban military, is basically throwing in the towel. They're giving up in this fight. And what's led to this is, you know, Morgan and others being incredibly brave, but also a whole sort of student uprising in the cities and young people standing up. So lots of Cubans all around the country are participating in this, even if the focal point is on the rebels in the mountains like Morgan. And Morgan had a little group called the Tigers of the Escambray Mountain that never lost a fight. And they were becoming renowned. They would have these rebel radio stations that would broadcast down to the cities the exploit of these rebel groups to try to have some ability to tell the story, because Batista dominated the traditional media there. And he wasn't telling any of these stories about the successes of the rebel. Hmm. So Cubans around the country began to hear these stories about the Americano. And he became sort of this legendary figure in their minds before they even knew what he looked like or really even knew who he was or what Americano even meant. Mm. And so Fidel Castro, obviously on the eastern end of the island, is aware of this. He's aware of this activity in the Escambray Mountains that's very successful. There's a huge free territory that they've created that the Cuban military won't enter. And so he realized that in order to finally win this battle, Fidel Castro does, that he needs to break the country in half. And where are Morgan and Manolio and his group? They're right in the middle of the country. So he sends Che Guevara across the country, leading a group of men to unify Morgan's group with Fidel's group. And Che Guevara enters their free territory. And one of the Second Front people says, well, what's the password? And Che Guevara doesn't know the password, of course. So he doesn't let him enter the free territory. So there's this immediate conflict between Fidel's group, represented by Che Guevara, and Manolio's group, represented by Morgan. And about 200 of Morgan and Manolio's forces, which now number a couple thousand, decide to go follow Che Guevara instead of staying with the Second Front. And so Morgan's standing there, and these guys say they're going to leave and go with Che. And he says, okay, you can leave and go with Che, but you can't take your weapons. Those are our weapons. You can leave here. Morgan's standing there with a couple other guys telling 200 armed people that they can't take their weapons. And it's a very tense moment. And at the end, they put down their weapons. They follow Che. But this tension between Che Guevara and Morgan and between the 26th of July movement, which is Fidel's group, and the Second Front, that becomes a tension that they don't seem to be able to overcome in the future.
Well, the other thing is that Morgan was somebody who was very idealistic and interested in Cuba becoming a free country and being democratic. And Che Guevara, even much more than Castro at that time, was a hardline ideological communist. I mean, he was a Marxist. So he was. They were 180 degrees apart politically, and they didn't like each other at all on that basis as well. So they basically were like oil and water, right? So,
absolutely true. I mean, there were rumors already, I mean, that Che was a serious Marxist that had filtered to them. And the whole Second Front operation had been built around the idea that they were not political, they were not ideological, and what they weren't going to do was allow communists to fight with them. That was partly strategic, because if Batista could convince the United States that he was actually fighting communism, the United States might give him more arms and more weapons to fight the rebels. But if the fight was against an internal civil war that wasn't ideological in the same way, or at least not in the Cold War, the United States wasn't going to give Batista weapons. So Manolio was very strict about not having ideological communists in his group.
So let's cut to the chase then, so to speak. Batista fled, he was chased out, at the end of 1958, and Castro and Morgan and all of their allies were triumphant. And so then later that year, I mean, things happened so quickly during that period, 58, 59, 60. And I guess early in 1959, Morgan foiled a CIA-backed plot by Rafael Trujillo of the Dominican Republic to overthrow Castro. Meanwhile, Batista had fled to the Dominican Republic, where kind of his fellow dictator was in charge. And so they wanted to conspire to take Cuba back from this fledgling revolution that had just triumphed, right? And so they contacted Morgan, the CIA did, and I guess actually the mafia as well offered him a bribe to kind of work with them and let Trujillo bring soldiers and guns in to try to overthrow Castro. But Morgan was kind of a double agent, and he kept Castro informed of what was going on. So when those troops did come in, Castro's forces just quickly overwhelmed them. So, I mean, he was basically at that point conspiring with Castro to keep Castro going and to keep the revolution going. So how did things begin to fall apart so quickly between Castro and Morgan?
Well, let me, if I may, you said everything perfectly, but set the context just a little bit. Right at the end of, just as Batista's leaving, Morgan goes down and takes military control of one of Cuba's big cities called Cienfuegos. He becomes basically the military mayor of Cienfuegos. Now, what's important is that you can imagine Batista's left, these rebels have won, journalists from all over flock to Cuba, a lot of them American, a lot of them English-speaking. Well, a natural interview for them is this American who speaks their language and participated in this. So Morgan reaches this level of sort of international celebrity and becomes very high profile because he's being interviewed like crazy by these American and foreign journalists who have come to report on what happened. So in early 59, he's approached by a mafia bagman, as you suggested, and said, how would you like to make $1 million? Well, Morgan guesses quickly that what might be worth $1 million is something pretty extreme, probably killing Castro. And so he goes to Castro and says, what do you want me to do? And Castro says, play it out, find out who's involved. Now, what's very interesting about this is all the different people who were involved. There was, as you said, the Dominican Republic, Rafael Trujillo, a brutal, brutal dictator. Batista's people who had left the country. The FBI, in this case, actually, not the CIA, but J. Edgar Hoover was the early person who wanted Castro out and was keeping an eye on this plot, very well informed about it, and was basically letting it play out. And so Morgan comes in as a double agent and is traveling back and forth between Havana and Miami, going to these meetings with all of these characters. And they end up giving him hundreds of thousands of dollars and guns to take back to Cuba to stage this counter-revolution against Castro. And an airplane flies in from the Dominican Republic, lands in the middle of Cuba, and these revolutionaries, counter-revolutionaries, get off, former Batista followers, and there is Fidel Castro standing there, and they're all arrested. And Morgan goes from being a hero in Cuba to being a celebrity in Cuba. And who do you think is tweaked by this deeply is J. Edgar Hoover. And Hoover says, we do not want young Americans going around and playing in Latin American revolutions anymore. I mean, this guy's glamorous. And if people think this is cool, they're going to be all over the place helping these Latin American revolutions. So he makes a high profile play for Morgan's citizenship, takes Morgan's citizenship away. And all of a sudden, there's Morgan in Cuba with a wife, a kid, and nowhere else to go.
That's quite a story, Aaron. And that's the kind of drama that's woven all through this story of William Morgan. And we're going to have to leave it there because we're out of time. But what I'd like to do is pick this up next week and kind of do part two of this show. But we have to leave it there. So, again, you can find Aaron Shetterly's book, The Americano, Fighting with Castro for Cuba's Freedom. And we will pick it up next week. So be sure to tune in if you've found yourself interested in this story, and we'll take it from there. So thank all of you for listening. I want to thank you, Aaron, and I hope you guys out there tune in again next week, same time, same place, for more American Variety Radio.